Hi, I'm Natalie Argarius, and this is the Urbanist Podcast, where we discuss news, information, and ideas about improving cities and quality of life.
And I'm Ray Dubicki. In this week's episode, we talk about the lingering haze that's deciding whether to clear from Western Washington. We've had weeks more smoke, even on a year that's had fewer wildfires. It's prompted us to start asking when the new emergency becomes the new norm. Stick around.
So Ray, when we've been discussing ideas for this week's podcast, I could not get past the fact that I've been glued to the airnow.gov website for the last few days. This summer, especially because it felt like it was so cool and rainy in June, I'd really hoped that we would not be impacted by wildfires and smoke this year, but that did not turn out to be the case.
It's been like a really extra gross season of smoke because it's continuing. It's not any of these super hazy days. It's just this kind of low level. Okay. It's just on the other edge of gross. And we've been stuck inside more often than not. The kids don't exactly get to ride their bikes to school every day. It's been a whole lot more bus traffic than we had in the past. Part of the reason that it's been super lingering is because we've had exceptionally dry summer since that wet June, and then continuing heat.
Can you share some of those rain totals with us? Because I was just absolutely floored by some of the numbers that you shared with me.
I couldn't believe it because the National Weather Service for Seattle pointed out they had a list of all of the precipitation totals for U.S. cities since July 1st. Juneau leads the list. They had 30 inches of rain, and it goes down some regular folks that we would expect. Miami, Chicago's been a little wet with 8 inches of rain. And then you cross a couple of folks before you get to Seattle. Phoenix had 1.9 inches. Vegas had 1.7 inches of rain. And then Seattle had literally a third of that with less than a half an inch of rain since the 1st of July.
Okay, you know that there's a major problem when you've received less rain than Phoenix and Las Vegas. That's just, to me, it's unimaginable.
I think we can see it just walking around the neighborhoods when the entire playground, all the grass around it is just crunchy. And we're in the middle of October.
So unfortunately, what this led to was the Bull Creek Fire, which has been the fire that's creating that smoke that's been plaguing us for now officially a month. So the fire started on September 10th. And it has been burning ever since. There are actually also two additional fires that are unnamed that are farther east out in the Cascades. And the Bull Creek Fire, it's significant. It's not huge when you compare it to some of the other fires we've had in previous years, but it's impacting 14,000 acres of forest land in the area near Highway 2 in Skykomish. There are about 220 firefighting staff who are working around the clock on containing it. But as of now, it's still only 36% contained.
As much as folks in Seattle recognize that Route 2 is so important getting east and west, sometimes it's locked out of our mind how directly east of the city Route 2 actually is, because we have to go up to Everett in order to connect to it. And then we hang a right and forget how far south it comes down, because Bolt Creek is almost exactly even east-west with North Seattle. I mean, it is literally right across the mountains from where we are.
Absolutely. It's not that far. And, you know, it's also important to point out that there aren't really that many east-west connectors in the state outside of Interstate 90. And Highway 2 is an important one. And it was closed for a while as a result of the fire.
All those folks that got called out and indexed in order to evacuate just at the spur of the moment. And it's continuing. I mean, that was weeks ago that folks had to leave their homes in order to avoid the beginning of the Bolt Creek fire.
I've read that businesses throughout the area have been really impacted because, you know, this might be part of the time, or at least back in September was part of the time in which they were getting some tourists, you know, people out hiking, camping, enjoying what should be some of the best time to be outdoors in our state in the year. And instead, you know, people had to flee.
Now, unfortunately, it seems that the Bolt Creek fire was actually human caused. Do we know if it is an accidental fire of some sort or somebody throwing a cigarette out of a moving car?
At this point, there are not a lot of details beyond the fact that it was human caused. They don't know if it was an accident. They don't know if it was negligence. They don't know if it was done with criminal intent. All of those are possibilities. I'm sure that it's probably pretty difficult to determine the cause of a fire, but it's absolutely appalling to me that the Washington Department of Natural Resources website estimates that 85% of forest fires are caused by humans and 52% are criminally or negligently caused.
It caught me off guard, somebody pointing out that even just the chains hanging between a trailer and a truck, if they're set too low, they can scrape and throw sparks into some of this super duper dry brush and cause fires that way. And that's at the very low end of negligence, that you've been told, hey, fix this, and happens anyway. The folks that go folks that go and cause fires criminally or even through higher levels of negligence is just astounding that half of the fires come from that.
And of course, I mean, here we're talking about direct causation, right? People engaging in actions that directly lead to forest fires, but we can't forget the fact that one of the conditions that's exacerbating these fires is climate change, which is, of course, a human-caused activity. If we hadn't had, you know, less rain than Phoenix this past summer, perhaps the fire would not have, you know, burnt as large of an area and as long.
So, hey, Natalie, how are you surviving actually being stuck in smoke this fall?
I'm going to be honest. I'm really not happy about it. I enjoy being outside, and I was really looking forward to enjoying outdoor activities, in particular this September. I try to find ways to keep myself occupied at home. I check the air quality regularly, like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode. And I have found that the airnow.gov website is by far the best in terms of giving reliable information. It's been a bummer.
I can't come up with a better word than just straight up bummer, because like I said, it's not that point where it's like, oh, this totally sucks. For missing an entire day or a weekend of stuff. It's just this lingering, ongoing nature of this particular smoke season is tremendous. It's a tremendous bummer.
And I also feel like, at least for me, it's changed how I live in the summer in Seattle now for enough years that it is starting to feel like a norm. I remember the first year where we were experiencing significant smoke, and I want to say it was perhaps 2017. I could be wrong, but I was working for Friends of Waterfront Seattle, and we were hosting these kayaking tours along with the University of Washington on the downtown seawall to showcase the ecological features of the seawall to people we hoped would be high level donors to the financial campaign for the waterfront project. And during the day, it didn't feel that gross to be out there. But at the end of the day, we would break down our tents, our pamphlets and tables and, you know, all the things that we'd set out. And there would be a fine layer of ash on them.
Oh, that's rough. I think it was 2017 because the oldest child was in fifth grade and she had soccer practice a couple times where we said, look, literally don't run around. Just we are outside because I don't know. We don't have anywhere else to have a soccer practice, but go inside, do your exercises there, and we will regroup in a week when this passed. But that was the beginning of September that year. And this year, it just keeps going.
Exactly. The fact that this has been going on for a month is just incredible. And like, you know, I think about in my own home, I don't have AC, but I do, use fans. It's not quite the same feeling when you have to keep the windows shut. So that, you know, has been an adjustment. And then I have an air filter, which I would have never imagined buying a device like that. That was something that it just never occurred to me that it would be something I'd need.
Like 3 weeks ago, I went to the hardware store looking at some of the air filters and thought, you know what? It's only going to be a couple more days, so I'll skip one at this year and maybe get one that's on sale over the winter or something. Should have bought it 3 weeks ago.
I've had mine now for, I think, 3 years, and I've gotten a ton of use out of it.
Troublingly high amount of use.
Exactly. In fact, I'm having to look into, hey, where's the spare replacement filter in it so that I can make sure it, you know, continues to work effectively? Because to be honest, if the, you know, if this Bull Creek fire is only 36% contained, how much longer are we going to be living with this? This could go on for a while.
So one of the barometers for around here in our household that something is amiss in the atmosphere is that youngest child starts to get nosebleeds. And unfortunately, it happens when the air conditioner comes on. It happens when the heater comes on. But this year, it's really kicked in because of this lingering grit in the air. And we've had to like double down on saline squirts and like Vaseline up the nostril and things like that. And it's gross. And it really illustrates how just pervasive the smoke ends up being in all of our sinus systems and everything else.
Exactly. It really, you know, results in health impacts. And quite frankly, you know, people are not equally exposed to this. So I'm lucky because I work at home. And if I decide that I have to sequester myself in home, like in my home, I have the chance to do that. There are people who live outside because they're unhoused, or, you know, the best way for them to get to work is to walk for 30 minutes or to bike or to take a bus. And all of those things become, you know, not only unpleasant, but at times dangerous when you're exposed to really bad air quality.
You mentioned that so much of the cause, the underlying cause for these fires is human caused climate change. But when we start getting into these fire seasons, it is so much easier to rely on our cars to suffer than to suffer outside if we have that ability. And those are higher consumption patterns protect some of us, but it totally leaves folks exposed. I mean, when we talk about the King County Regional Homeless Authority being able to open emergency shelters with beds that are not exposed, but are people actually taking advantage of that?
From what I read, the usage rates of these shelters has been pretty low, and it might be because of what you were talking about earlier. It becomes, unfortunately, something that we get accustomed to. Like, even if it's comfortable, even if we can see uncomfortable, even if we can see the haze, perhaps if you're somebody who's unhoused and you're used to being outside all the time, you're kind of very slowly getting habituated to the poor air quality, and you don't even reflect, you know, or maybe you just don't feel as impacted as you really are being by it.
I mean, there's that frog in the boiling water versus frog in the slowly warming water anecdote, that, you know, if you can cook them, if the heat slowly goes up, that this feels like a slow boil.
And so, yeah, I think that is the perfect metaphor to put forth. And it's actually what really scares me about the smoke, but also, you know, some of the other impacts that we're seeing as a result of climate change. Because for the people who have money, the solution with the smoke is to spend more money on electricity, to run their air filters, to drive cars, to stay inside, to go to places like the mall where the air has been mostly cleaned. And then, you know, all of those things are leading to the higher consumption patterns you referenced earlier that are negatively contributing to climate change. This was something I saw years ago when I did a trip to India, and I stayed with some friends there for a few weeks. I spent most of my time in Mumbai, but I did travel around the country a little bit. Mumbai is not known for having especially bad air for India. In fact, because it's coastal, it has much better air than Delhi, the capital city. At the same time, by the end of my trip, I just simply didn't want to go outside. I just wanted to stay inside where the air was cleaner to breathe. And at, you know, it's hard because then you look out the window and you see there are people who literally live outside in those conditions all the time.
It's yet another thing that the wealthy can pay their way out of. They don't have to suffer through the heat. They don't have to suffer through just lung ripping ash, and they don't have to suffer through many of the things that folks, the rest of the world does.
We've been talking about, you know, some really big picture issues, climate change, people with resources, you know, living in high consumption patterns. And there are many ways, of course, in which, you know, our societies can and should be changing. That kind of change feels sort of far off. I hate to put it like that, or like it will really demand, you know, a lot of concentrated effort, economic necessity, policy goals. So let's talk about like, okay, how can we prevent forest fires now? Or like, what can we be doing now to at least make this problem less significant than it feels like it's becoming?
I grew up with Smokey the Bear, and it was so fascinating to go to some of the national parks recently and see how they are departing from that absolute there cannot be forest fires to, you know what, we need a whole bunch of forest fires to prevent the really terrible one.
That's true. So, you know, for a long time, I think when we were doing land management in this country, we didn't understand the importance of fires to the ecosystem and the importance of controlled burns and smaller fires for clearing out brush and grasses and other highly flammable natural materials. So that, you know, that could potentially be a positive in the future if we're investing enough, of course, and engaging in these practices responsibly. And then there, as people who go out to visit the woods, you know, camping, hiking, whatever, I think we can continue to follow some of those tips that good old Smokey the Bear had shared with us about, like, you know, being responsible about creating our fires. If we're going to, you know, roast marshmallows or do whatever in the evening, you know, making sure that they're in an appropriate area and that they're fully distinguished. Making sure that they're fully extinguished at the,
it's a fire with a bow tie on it.
Exactly. Well, I was just going to say that I was trying to look up, like, you know, some additional tips. And what really surprised me, and this relates back to the thing you referenced about the chains that can drag on the ground and create sparks and contribute to fires. There's a lot of car related stuff. Like, don't park your car on dry grass. That's something that I had never really thought about. Or if your car may be leaking motor oil, just don't bring it out to the forest. Bad idea. You'll be leaving a trail of highly flammable liquid that could end up, you know, being one of those contributing factors to a negligently caused forest fire.
I would never have thought it would be like a Looney Tune with the barrel leaking stuff that Wile E. Coyote is carting in way, and somebody just goes click and it just follows them up the hill. All of the car stuff and to the cigarette butts and all of the fireworks things just never. I mean, that was that in so many ways, that was like part of going out to the woods that you got to do some of that questionable stuff. And that's a cause for many of these forest fires. That's the human cause of so much of this stuff.
And I'm also going to just put it out there. Do not bring firecrackers. Do not bring fireworks. No, you know, even the small ones, just don't bring them out there. The forest fire in Oregon that occurred a few years ago, the Eagle Creek fire that burned 48,000 acres of forest land in Mount Hood, that was caused by a 15-year-old with a smoke bomb, who simply thought, oh, it'd be really fun to throw this smoke bomb. And it could have fallen into any number of places, but it fell right in a spot where it led to a massive fire. And I mean, it's hard to imagine the damage that caused.
And it's a smoke bomb. People don't think of that as being fire. And it is. It is on that list of stuff that is just kind of right on the edge. Oh, this is just fun time. Ha ha ha. Nope. This is just off the list. Let's have a good time without some of this stuff.
In addition to these kind of just like ideas around being responsible humans when we go out into nature and having, you know, controlled burns be engaged in by the Department of Natural Resources and other entities that are managing forests, our Department of Natural Resource director in the state, Hillary Franz, she has a really awesome plan to remove smaller trees. And by doing so, transform them into cross-laminated timber, which is a material that is getting more and more widely used in the building industry. This could be a wonderful way in which we could be responsibly managing our forests, preventing forest fires, and also creating material that could be good for the economy and used to build affordable housing.
Washington built many of its initial industries off of being able to export the enormous trees that were around Seattle. I mean, we exported how many of those in order to rebuild San Francisco after their earthquake and fire in the 1800s? Now we have an opportunity to save ourselves from smoke season in order to start up a stronger industry for cross-laminated timber and really manage the resources that we have now with the smaller trees that are, you know, kind of left behind after our initial go-through.
Exactly. And, you know, right now, it seems like we're making good progress. According to a 2019 article from Crosscut, the DNR created a 20-year forest health plan that would restore about 1.5 million acres of state, federal, and private forest in Washington by 2033. And as part of that, there would be the removal of these smaller trees and transformation of them into cross-laminated timber. At the same time, Franz has said there's 2.7 million acres of dead and dying timber that could be used to create cross-laminated timber. So we might need to be leaning a whole lot harder into this than we currently are.
The amazing thing is that when we're talking about dead and dying timber, we're not talking just about potential uses for buildings. We're talking about tinder for the next wildfire. Whether or not it's negligently set or not, it's coming. And so getting prepared for that is a great systemic opportunity in order to avoid the kind of smoke season we're having this year.
Exactly. And, you know, it is a good thing that cross-laminated timber seems to be taking off as a building material. Washington Building Code now allows for buildings as tall as 18 stories, which is pretty tall. I mean, we have some buildings that are higher than that in Seattle, but not a whole lot, quite honestly. And we even have a project in First Hill made out of cross-laminated timber that is at 1422 Seneca Street. And it's pushing forward and it's going to hit that. It's going to be as tall as 18 stories. So it's going to be finally fulfilling what the building codes will allow for.
That's astounding because, I mean, we've been hearing, listening to some of the building and architect concepts over the last few years, cross-laminated timber has popped up. And it really always is a question of when is it coming to Washington State because we have such an enormous timber industry. So it's great to actually see it come to fruition.
Yes, I cannot say that enough. This was now several years ago. I went on a walking tour with what was then Capitol Hill Housing, is now Community Roots Housing, in which they talked to us about some properties that they owned in Capitol Hill near I-5, so kind of getting close to downtown and the convention center. And they also talked about some of their plans for building new properties. And the leader of that tour was really excited to talk about cross-laminated timber as a potential building material. And at that time, they did not have any projects in the works with the material. But now they actually do. So there's the Heartwood development, which is going to be an affordable housing development by Community Roots Housing. It's going to be 8 stories located on East Union and Capitol Hill. Now, there's one thing about it that's a little bit disappointing, which is that the actual material itself and the know-how around that is going to be provided by Timber Lab, which is based out of Oregon. So it appears Oregon might be a few steps ahead of us. Now, granted, really good to see that they're also, you know, embracing this opportunity, but it would be nice if, you know, in Washington, we could have a thriving cross-laminated timber industry as well.
It is interesting when we start talking about the intersection between the stuff we can do very personally. You know, don't drive on grass with the hot bottom of your car ready to set everything on fire. And then some of the kind of mid-range systemic stuff that we can do, like finding ways to build with this cross-laminated timber and really boosting the kind of industry that can use some of the tinder that's ready to burst into flames at any time. I mean, many of us spent years buying weird organic food thinking, hey, we're going to have organic food and we're going to spend a little bit more now so we can get it into the future. This is the same thing that if you have the opportunity to build your deck, look for cross-laminated timber so that it can actually boost the economy and boost the industry in the state.
Exactly. And I have to say, Ray, when I proposed this as a topic, I was like, this is going to be a depressing topic. It's going to be, you know, one that's difficult to talk about, or it's going to be too information heavy, and people are going to walk away from this feeling like, oh, you know, cities and society and life are just getting worse. But I feel like there is a little bit of glimmer of hope around this. I feel like, you know, at the very least, when we think about how we can engage in these actions that will result in positive change, it reserves some space for optimism in my heart, at least.
And that's it for this week's podcast. We do have a note from Mark Rogers. He wrote in and said, I enjoyed the episode about bringing movie making back to Seattle. I think you may have overlooked a TV show recently shot in Seattle, HBO's The Sex Lives of College Girls. Mark, I did overlook that. I'm sorry. The University of Washington, where I teach, is the location for the show's fictional Essex University in the upcoming second season. It wasn't just a few establishing shots. They filmed on campus a lot, on and off over many months, and it was frankly sometimes a little disruptive. My office is right on the quad, which is famously picturesque. I found it amusingly ironic that a fictional college was making my real university office a little less accessible. Sorry to hear that, Mark. And the hilarious part is that Seattle doesn't always play itself, but we do get to play a fictional Essex University. Thank you, Mark. We do love to hear your thoughts. Send your observations, comments, and criticisms to podcast@theurbanist.org.
And I just also wanted to mention that The Urbanist is finishing up its fall subscriber drive. Every one of you who donates supports this podcast, the other work that we do, including all of the great reporting from our correspondents who write about things from Olympia through Linwood. We really appreciate this support. Our subscriber drives are actually the number one way in which we raise the revenue that makes The Urbanist possible. So if you do enjoy this podcast and then the articles that you read on the website and also other activities that we engage in, like our walking tours, our monthly meetups, our book club, then please hit that donate button on theurbanist.org.
Thank you for listening, and hopefully thank you for your donation and support. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, I'm Ray DeBicke.
And I'm Natalie Argarius. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk again soon.